once I see that the device works properly, it release me.
I very much doubt it. You see, before you reactivated it, I reversed the polarity of the neutron flow.
You realize what will happen?
Oh, yes. Do you? Well, I've reversed the polarity of the neutron flow, so the TARDIS should be free of the force field now.
So he's reversed the polarity! Keep back!
Hello and welcome to today's episode of Reversing Polarity, a very gay Doctor Who podcast where this week we are reaching out to the astrology gays and talking about 10 entire planets. My name is Aim and my pronouns are they, them.
My name is Rosie. I'm eating a cookie. My pronouns are also they, them.
How are you doing today?
I'm very good. I'm
other than the cookie.
Cookie.
I'm quite envious of the cookie. Mm. Should have got a cookie.
I've
got
cream eggs in the cupboard. In the podcast.
Good, it should. It's valid.
As you know, if you open the fancy cream egg, you're not allowed to eat it. They're so insistent on advertising that you're not allowed to eat it. It's like, I know I'm not supposed to eat the cream egg that's fancy.
However, I'm yet to open the fancy cream egg, so I'm not too worried. We get our cream eggs from Aldi, so I think we're getting last year's leftover surplus of cream eggs. Not too worried.
Fair enough.
What cereal are we discussing today?
We are discussing... Hang on, I actually do need to finish swallowing this cookie.
Okay, we're discussing the 10th planet, which
is the
first...
I was
going to
say the sentence, it's just that I needed to swallow the cookie.
I'm feeling very, like, punchy? Mm. Peppy today.
Mm. But yeah.
Like a little dog who just wants to jump around and bark.
Yeah, we watched the 10th planet. We had to delay recording this many times, and in fact, we've definitely already recorded the previous episode that we definitely did about Wang Chiang. Wow.
I really enjoyed the point that we made about insert comment here.
What an incredible episode that was that we recorded, that we've definitely already recorded, and we're definitely not procrastinating because we don't want to finish watching The Talons of Wang Chiang.
Starting.
I have to finish reading Edward Said's Orientalism first, so that could take years.
That's fair. That's fair. But this was a much needed breath of fresh air from the, oh no, we need to talk about Wang Chiang.
Absolutely. One Ben and Polly, an ultimate team. Very good team.
And just a very good story.
Very good story, absolutely.
I thought I'd seen this one before, but I hadn't seen it before. I just heard people talk about it so much that I thought I'd seen it.
I've seen it at least 4 times now.
It slaps. Mm. It's really good.
It's very, very good. The Cybermen really went off. Yeah, so this is the final First Doctor serial.
And it doesn't have massive finale energy because it's story 2 of a series.
Yeah, it's...
Which I kind of like.
It's sort of this interesting... It sort of builds up to the regeneration in a way where you're like, something very strange is going on, but you don't know quite what, which makes sense. Even as people who know about regeneration, it still feels like no one knows what the hell is going on. And the Doctor's not 100% sure either. It's pretty interesting.
Which, we won't have got to... We might have had the Easter special come out by now, but...
What's our Easter special going to be?
No, the actual Doctor Who Easter special.
Okay, Legend of the Sea Devils.
In ours, we're going to do a Easter egg hunt somehow, virtually.
We're going to talk about Jesus in Doctor Who. That's going to be a really productive discussion, I think.
That could actually be a really fun episode.
Yeah, so I've seen the serial probably 4 times. I watched it as a child because my parents had it in a big metal tin. And it was the 10th planet, but it had a recon for the last episode, so I had no fucking idea what was going on. Like, just no fucking idea what was going on. And then I watched it...
Recons are hard enough to follow as an adult.
I think I watched it at least once more with the animation, just, like, as a teen. And then more recently, I watched it during my Cybermen marathon, and then I watched it again while I was at work one morning, because I just needed some Doctor Who on. And then I watched it again for this, so I've watched it many times, and it's just great.
I was glad to have finally seen it and to get what the fuss was about. Shall we jump into the synopsis?
Yes. So, the Doctor's TARDIS lands at the Snowcap Space Tracking Station in Antarctica in December 1986. A routine space mission starts going wrong. When the base personnel's suspicions are roused, the Doctor informs them that the space capsule is being affected by the gravitational pull of another planet, a 10th planet in the solar system. The loss of a routine space... Hang on, I can't speak. I think I don't need to say that. I don't think I need to say most of the second paragraph. Hang on. The appearance of that planet in the sky heralds the arrival of the Cybermen, who are intent on the destruction of the Earth and the conversion of all humans into Cybermen. I would argue that that's not part of their initial plan.
No.
Ben and Polly fight to save the world, but it is a battle that may be the Doctor's very last. And it is very definitely Ben and Polly and the Doctor, this serial.
Doing most of it. Yeah, they're quite separate. Cool pitch, I think.
It's a good premise. This is the first story that Kit Pedler is directly involved in writing. He had been brought on as the scientific advisor sort of recently. And then Jerry Davis is, I think, the script editor. So I guess he just had to make sure that it was like in character. But for a first serial, this is pretty much a banger from Kit Pedler.
Really strong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good pacing. Great character moments for our expanded cast. Episode one. It starts by having these little like graphics above the the intro. They're so cute. They're like little, it almost says it's like M's and O's and Z's and stuff. It's very cute. I really like that.
I really like this era of Doctor Who where they're experimenting with the title and end
sequences.
They're
playing. Yes.
And also with the on-screen graphics, because there's a great bit at the end of, is it episode 2 or 3, where there's like a countdown on screen. You're like, oh my god.
Yes. End of episode 3.
It's good, and it reminds me, the Time Meddler, they have like a completely different end sequence, which they've never done ever again, and I was like, man, I kind of wish they would bring that back, because it was kind of fucking cool.
That's cool. That's exciting.
Yeah.
Anyway, episode one starts. The Snowcap Space Tracking Station, based on the South Pole, is monitoring the launch of the manned Zeus 4 atmospheric testing probe as it goes into orbit. The ship is manned by two pilots, Schultz and Williams.
Now, it must be noted that it's kind of stupid to have a manned atmospheric testing probe. Why would that not be computerized?
Because then we have characters there, we add the dramatic tension.
But I just mean that it could have been anything. It could have been anything. They could have been going to the International Space Station, or they could be going to Skylab, but instead it's like, we're going to be testing the atmosphere and then coming back, I guess.
Let's go.
I feel like they'd conceptualized the idea of having like lots of space travel, but they hadn't thought about how to do space transmission at this point.
Which is frankly fair enough.
Kit Pedler was like, I can't think of anything fancier than radio, so we're just not going to mention it.
The Doctor, Ben and Polly materialise outside the underground bunker of Snowcap.
They individually materialise. That's what goes down. Thank you, TARDIS Wiki.
And are soon spotted by men watching the surrounded areas through a periscope, which I really enjoyed this scene. It's obviously like a barracks for a bunch of army blokes, and one of them's on the periscope. It's like, there's a woman!
I think you'll find that what happens is that the guy on the periscope goes, there's a bunch of guys there, and Private Tito, who has a wall covered with pinups of women, goes, a woman?!
So strong.
Yeah, lots of people. I think some people might recognise that quote from our wife drop, because it has been our wife drop for the entire series. 41 episodes in, we finally get to encounter the wife drop in real life.
We've got 120 episodes to go, so.
Yeah, I'm sure there's more drops that we'll encounter.
Not bad going.
Although never the one for the behind-the-scenes drop, because it is from Time Slip and not Doctor Who. Sorry, everybody. But yeah, so basically the TARDIS materialises and then they're having a little argument, and then Ben and Polly just go and put on some lovely warm clothes. This is the bit where Polly says to Ben, like, where do you shop Carnaby Street?
It's really, really good. Very charming.
I love them. And Polly brings the Doctor his outfit, and it is his iconic regeneration outfit with the little peaked cap, or not peaked cap.
The cape.
The sort of, it's a particular type of military cap, but I don't know what it's called. And the cape and the scarf, and it's fucking fantastic. It's what David Bradley wears in Twice Upon a Time. It just looks great.
It's what my dad wears when he's cold.
Yes, absolutely.
My dad has
the periscope is great also, because Polly goes, hey, what's this? Is there something down there? And Ben's like, get away from that, Polly. It's a type of periscope. And you're like, Ben getting to know stuff about the Navy.
Yeah.
They're very well characterised in this serial, I think.
They really are. Yeah. Inside Snowcap, the Doctor, Polly and Ben are interrogated. General Cutler is sent for and responds hostilely to the strangers.
He's American.
Cutler decides... Yes, just as a very strong American
hostile
accent.
Character, American.
Cutler decides to put them in the observation room until he has to deal with them later. Once there, the Doctor notices a calendar on the wall saying it's December 1986, the far-flung future. Ben is disappointed he won't be able to meet up with his ship, but seems more interested when he discovers that space travel is the norm.
This is a very cute scene, because they're all having this discussion.
It's also wild to think that, like, in effectively 20 years, space travel could be the norm.
It's like, Ben turns to Pauline and is like, hey, do you reckon they've got to the moon yet? And the random American sergeant is like, yeah, we just said a patrol just got back last week or whatever. And you're like, that's really cute, you know?
That's very cute.
I like the sort of optimism of that assumption paired with a lot of very unoptimistic, like pessimistic thoughts about how humanity would respond to certain threats. It's a good episode.
This conversation is interrupted by a distress call from the Zeus 4 space capsule, which has been drawn off course by an unknown force that drains the energy.
Indeed. The Australian and Earl Cameron. I don't know the Australian guy's actor's name. He's called Bluey by Earl Cameron's character. Don't know why.
Let me grab the cast list for you. It's Schultz, played by Alan White.
Alan White, wow. Yeah, I guess this is the point to mention. Williams is played by Earl Cameron, but he was the first sort of main character black actor in Doctor Who, although I guess you could debatably call him a main character.
He has quite a bit of screen time compared to some, and I think in the original script it wasn't pitched as a black character, but it fit when they were doing the casting and looking at the themes of the episode, and I'm very glad they did it.
Yeah, he was awesome.
Very cool guy. Worth spending some time reading about Earl Cameron.
Oh, he was in Inception, apparently, as elderly, bald man.
He was
man.
In so many things.
But yeah, so he's yeah. I don't
Boy,
mean to say, like,
accidentally added.
I'm not sure whether famous is the right word, but he's one of the, like...
Well-regarded.
Yeah, most well-regarded and definitely very important figure in the history of black British acting, etc. Yeah, he was very cool.
The pilots of Zeus 4 explore that it is nowhere near the destination in which they had expect to be. Observing their location, Schultz sees another planet. Williams confirms this and says it seems to lie between Mars and Venus. Their state is also brought into confusion by the fact that communication to Snowcap is weakened and their fuel is dropping much faster than normal. I really like this bit of suspense
it's
building.
It's very strange. There's lots of weird things going on and you don't quite know why. It's good.
Yeah. Observing the crisis, the Doctor announces that he believes he knows the cause of their problems. He is not listened to, but gives a piece of paper to Dr. Barclay.
It's so fun. Just all the interactions between the Doctor and sort of parts of the base. Like, some of them accept him pretty immediately. Fucking Cutler hates him. He hates him so much. He's like, oh, this fucking British cunt. Don't care.
Do you not know that I have other problems?
Yeah, he wants him to go away quite badly, but the problem is that the Doctor won't go away until justice is served.
Snowcap sights the new planet before they receive the call from Zeus 4 saying their fuel has reached 20%. Barclay says they should attempt to come down. Schultz and Williams attempt to land, but they have no control over their descent as the new planet is affecting their gravitational pull.
Whoa, gravity.
I'm also not entirely sure that that's how that would go down, but I don't. I'm not a spaceman.
Well, I know that, like, definitely gravitational problems. Whether it's that what they would normally do in this situation, because they had reached orbit with Earth, they would like do a certain amount of like propulsion towards Earth and then just be pulled in by the gravitational field. I guess having a second planet nearby means that there's like a competing force.
Yep, so your gravity is not acting as you'd expect it to go.
That's my assumption. Yeah. I do not have anything above a GCSE in physics.
Oh, I got a D in my GCSE physics.
Nice. I will not tell you what I got in my GCSE physics, just for comfort's sake. It wasn't an A star.
Was it above a D?
It was above a D. But I got an E in A level biology, so we're equal.
I got a D's in physics and Latin, because I was too excited to read about Roman culture and I cared not for the grammar.
That is fair. At school, they do, they sing the verb endings to We Will Rock You.
That's adorable.
O-S-T-M-U-S, tis-unt, tis-unt. I, you, he, she, it, we, you, they. It's great.
I don't know if that would have helped me learn it any better, no, but I hope it helps
I
somebody.
I don't know any of the verbs that I would put those on the end of, but if you gave me a Latin verb and went, here's this. Saying, I would go, well, I think that's a first person verb, actually.
Anyway, exasperated, Barclay goes to the Doctor for advice. The Doctor looks at a screen with a planet on it and observes that it's identical to Earth, down to the land masses. The Doctor asks Barclay to look at the piece of paper that he had given him, and Barclay is astounded to read that the Doctor had predicted this phenomenon before they'd even seen it.
Showmanship.
It's very fancy.
Also,
I wish I could pull it off one day.
I want to know, the Doctor is...
Oh, look at the piece of paper I gave you half an hour ago.
The Doctor is not the one who notes that it's identical to Earth. Polly recognises Malaysia, and then Ben and Polly...
Icon.
And
queen behaviour.
...sort of notice the different land masses. And Polly's like, it is Malaysia, because she can't say Malaysia like a normal person. Yeah, it's just upside down Earth, and I love it so much.
The Doctor tries to explain how he knew this, saying that millions of years ago there was a twin planet to Earth. But before he can go into any more detail, Cutler storms out saying, This is ridiculous!
I've heard of scientific explanations, but this is ridiculous!
Science? This is no science. I can't.
Yeah, hang on. I'm sorry. No, I can only do the fake American accent the other guy's doing. General Cutler's American accent is actually too good to mimic, I think.
To mimic badly.
Yeah. How dare when you, alone, our impressions doctor... are perfect.
It's because we're perfect. When alone, the Doctor explains to Ben that he fears this means invasion.
Ooh.
Mm. Cutler speaks to Mr. Wigner, the Secretary General of the International Space Command, and informs him of the new planet as well as the strangers. Wigner demands that they be interrogated immediately. Cutler storms in and demands the truth from the Doctor. He suspects him of being involved in this mystery, which is, in fairness, quite a rational suspicion to
have. Yeah, the
have,
Doctor does always turn up around the beginning of problems.
Mm. Mm. Mm-hmm.
He solves problems Strange, on that. Purpose, but unfortunately, the like from an outsider's perspective, it does look like he causes them on purpose as well.
Sometimes he does.
Yeah.
He sends Tyto, the Sergeant, and Joe out to search the TARDIS. The three men scramble to the TARDIS. Before they can get out, a mysterious ship lands on the surface of the South Pole. Unable to open the TARDIS, the Sergeant sends Tyto and Joe back to get a welder. Whilst alone, he's approached by a robotic creature who kills him with a blow to the
Whoa.
Neck. It's very good. When Tyto and the other soldier return, the creature is disguised in the sergeant's clothes.
So well.
When he turns to reveal himself, two more robotic creatures appear and kill the two soldiers with blows to the neck. The three creatures loom over their victims. I absolutely love
It's so good. I mean, poor Tyto. He died of loving women too much.
I mean, that's what will also be on my death certificate, so that's fine.
Absolutely. He was too much of a wife guy, and the Cyberman knew. They knew they would never be able to take the emotions out of that man. The Cyberman reveal is so fucking
it's
good!
It's brilliant! It's so... The level of tension is spot on. The camera angles are really interesting.
And I love this sort of... Oh. The dead-eyed stare the Cyberman gives the camera as we cut to the next time.
As opposed to those normal cheeky glances that it
gives.
But
you know what I mean? Like, just...
Yeah, I know.
Full on into the camera and you're staring at it like... You
and
because
they're so new
people.
And so... Yeah, I love it. Very strong. 12 out of 10. Really like this is a setup episode, setting up all of the different levels of the conflict, and then it's just throwing the side. Chef's kiss.
It's very good. Like, you know, there must be something else to it because Doctor Who stories rarely revolve around the position of planets in the sky, unless you are the twin dilemma. So you know that there's got to be something else here, and in this case, it's not a big slug guy. It's the Cybermen.
Sadly,
yeah. If only Mestor was here, he would have really elevated this story. There are so many serials we've watched, which I really enjoyed, but cannot remember the name of some characters. But the Twin Dilemma is seared in my mind. It is, like, it's impossible to forget.
Do you want to... We should design a t-shirt that says, we'll always have Mestor.
Yeah, really fucking good episode. I really like how it sort of sets up the environment of the base, and then it just kills a bunch of guys. Like, hey, you vaguely liked these guys. They're dead now. Enjoy. Now some guys are going to...
See you later!
Some really big cyber dudes are going to steal their coats as if that's going to conceal anything about them.
As soon as somebody sees their face, they're like, wait a second.
Yeah, wait a second. Why is your head so tall now? Why have you got...
You definitely weren't wearing a mask
on?
Earlier.
Yeah. So episode 2. The Doctor reasserts his belief that there will be visitors to Earth from the mystery planet, but is poo-pooed by Cutler. Cutler speaks to Zeus 4 and promises the pilots they will be brought back safely. A bad promise to make.
Yeah, generally not one that you want to be.
Yeah. Outside Snowcap, the robots disguise themselves in the clothes of their now-dead victims. They literally just put the coats on over their big helmet lamps. And I love it. I think that's really great that they just assume that that would disguise them because they don't have emotions anymore, so they can't feel shame or embarrassment at how shit their disguise is.
But they do retain knowledge. They must know.
Yeah, but do they now, can they retain the emotional context of the knowledge? Where they go, I could put this coat on and it will look like
but
this.
But I would look silly.
But I don't think they know that they can't get embarrassed by the mental image of themselves. Also, have they ever looked in a mirror? Hmm. We don't know if they've ever looked in a mirror.
Maybe they think they still look like humans.
Maybe they do. It's a big question.
Maybe they have perception filters, so they see other Cybermen as they want to.
Didn't that happen in That's World Enough worse. In Time? I haven't seen World Enough in Time. There's a whole Can't thing remember. Where some people see Bill as a Cyberman and the Doctor doesn't, I think.
Yes. Yep, there is.
There you are.
Yep. Oh, Bill.
More Daisy and Cybermen.
My love.
I guess we should sort of attempt to describe what we're being presented with in our eyeballs. So the Mondasian Cybermen, the very original Cybermen design... it's sort of a boiler suit situation. Their hands are still visible. They still have human hands. They have a big sock over their head and black cloth at the mouth and eyes with sort of metal rings around the eyes. And then a big headlamp with handlebars on top of their head. And they're wearing big chunky yes. hiking boots. And it's all yeah. silver. And yeah, and
it
they
is
have,
so uncanny.
And they have this massive chest unit and big... And another big lamp that is their ray gun. And somehow it is so scary. Like,
I don't know what it is about it. It's just so incredibly intimidating.
I think we're going to talk about this later, but I think it's because it feels yeah. like the most closely linked to humanity while still being definitely not people. Definitely yeah. not people. And we'll...
Yeah, definitely
we'll
not
hear
people.
Another remove from their peopleness in, soon, I guess. Mm. At International Space Command, a powerless Wigner is forced to watch the news to learn about the mystery planet. As communications have been severed with Snowcap. So International Space Command, Wigner or Wiener or Viner, or however you say it, he is French. There is a black actor in sort of a... I know that there's a name for it.
I am unsure.
What like a wear. Kaftan? I don't know. He's wearing some sort of traditional clothing and looking at some files. Every other character is just wearing a uniform.
Mm-hmm. Hey, they get the wonkiest you tried
They get
star.
The wonkiest you tried star. There's two women there. I just wanted to mention that. There's two women. And they say, yes, sir. And here's the file, essentially. I definitely did feel like going, a woman! When they turned up. So.
Yeah.
But yeah, and yeah. The news segment is so charming. It's...
I like
yeah,
this.
Yeah, no, I know.
As a
it's
bit.
Like international news station, and then they read out these news bits. So, so lovely.
I'm still on my Warehouse 13 rewatch, and there was this bit where there was a global plague.
Oh, God.
It's okay. They solved it within 45 minutes.
Oh, that's nice for them.
But they were using a similar bit with having the TV channels reporting on it.
Yeah.
And they were like, wow, people are recognising there's a plague. All UK schools are immediately closed. Everyone has gone into hiding. And I'm like, oh wow, oh God. We've been ruined for plague media.
Indeed. There's some problems there, huh?
That has nothing to do with the 10th planet, but I like it as a way to share yeah. story beats.
While everyone is distracted by their efforts to land Zeus 4 safely, the alien invaders enter the base, killing a soldier who tries to disable them on the orders of Cutler. The base personnel and Polly plead with the creatures to allow them to save the lives of the Zeus 4 crew, but the aliens proclaim that the lives of the humans are irrelevant to them. It's like, people are dying all the time on this planet! Why do you care about these people? Like, oh, mate.
Yeah, have we discussed their voices
I
yet?
I think we need to, because it's actually very hard to imitate. Well done, Roy Skelton. Feelings?
They're so...
We do not have feelings.
They're as distorted as the Daleks, but with a complete opposite intonation.
Sorry, I just nearly redid my joke from the Moonbase episode where I said, feelings? We do not have feelings. We're just really good at digging tunnels. yeah, it's very sing-song and sort of the cadence is completely wrong and it's very weird. Oh. Like, I have a quote from it here. Yeah, so, come to Mondas and you will have no need of emotions. You will become like us. We have freedom from disease, protection against heat and cold, true mastery. Do you prefer to die in misery? Like, oh my God. They're really something, is what we're saying. It's a whole...
It's high drama in a very good
indeed.
Way.
Indeed. And they're so physically imposing, because they're all like 6 feet tall. Mm. Ah! Also, Polly is so fucking brave. She like shouts at them. properly shouts at them. I love her.
I think I would flee in the face of Mondasian.
I would flee and die of hypothermia immediately.
Be gone.
But yeah, so they reveal that they are known as Cybermen and were once like human beings. And you can tell because you can see their eyes. Ah! They lived on the planet Mondas, twinned with Earth. As Mondas drifted off into space, not how gravity works, but it's all right, Kit Peddler, you know. As Mondas drifted off into
space... only the show's scientific advisor.
Yeah, there's no problems with that. As Mondas drifted off into space, cybernetic scientists gradually replaced their bodies with mechanical parts and eliminated the weaknesses of illnesses and emotions from their brain. So I guess you can't have depressed Cybermen. But in a way, are they not all in flat affect and not finding joy in things they previously enjoyed? So maybe actually all Cybermen are depressed.
Also, I'm not depressed, but they've made it...
They have executive function.
Depathologized it, I guess.
Yeah. All Cybermen are depressed. Depression is a human illness. Cybermen are human. Yes? You know what a human would say to that? Sorry, I...
Are you okay?
Yeah, no, I'm totally fine. I'm just trying to make jokes and I'm not managing it quite. I'm doing my best.
It's okay, it's okay. The energy is there. We'll get there.
Cutler presses a panic button alerting International Space Control to an emergency. You should not have done that! Basically. International Space Control gets in touch with Cutler and the Cybermen order Cutler to inform them that it was a false alarm. Cutler refuses and is rendered unconscious by the touch of a Cyberman. I love the sort of incapacitating sort of caresses that they give people.
It's not quite Vulcan nerve pinching.
No, but it's close. It's not even Vulcan nerve chopping. It's just...
Which is how they kill
people. Yeah, it is what it is. It's a Kirk chop to kill people. And just a hand to the face to do whatever. God, imagine how cold their hands must be.
Maybe that's why they chose the Arctic.
Maybe. Antarctic, but either way.
Shh.
It doesn't really matter.
The cold place.
The cold place. We do not need warmth. We are simply very good
at
throwing snowballs.
We have a snowball competition among us. Join us so you can compete.
Yeah. Well, we know that Mondas is very cold, so I guess that would make sense. Barclay is approached to do the same and refuses until the Cybermen threaten to destroy the computers that would help Zeus 4 to land. Barclay yields, stating it as a fault. Once this has been done, the Cybermen inform Barclay it is impossible for the astronauts to return as Mondas' gravitational force is too close. Yikes. As the Cybermen begin the process of securing Snowcap, Ben plans their escape. Seeing a gun left on the ground by the dead soldier, he picks it up, but is soon spotted by a Cyberman. The gun is removed and bent in the Cyberman's grip, and Ben is removed and imprisoned in a projection room. Fucking cool. Baller effect.
Very cool.
Love it.
Very badass. Yeah.
Just a moment of going, oh, they're strong, huh? That's gonna be great.
That's good to know. Yeah. Great, cool.
Good to know, just sussing
out. I like the reveal of what the Cybermen do, how they do it, and what they're about are really well paced.
Yeah, it's definitely...
It's gonna be interesting. Go on.
No, I was gonna say they're really building the enemy really well.
Yeah. I was gonna say it's gonna be interesting to compare this to when we finally get to the Daleks.
God!
As an introduction to a classic villain.
I
think that the Daleks is not a very well paced serial, actually.
No, because it's 7 parts, but it does have a good introduction. It's just that then it sort of meanders.
The first part is baller.
Meanders in about episodes 3 through 5. Sorry, Chris Barry.
Yeah.
I know you directed some of it and it was good, but the scripting did not help you. Sorry to friend of the show, Terry Nation. Can't be telling
hey,
him.
Hey, yeah.
But yeah, so he's imprisoned in the projection room and immediately is like, well, what can I do with this situation? Because he's very proactive, Ben. I love him.
It's very pragmatic. It's a nice little bit of escape room energy.
Indeed. He's like, well, maybe if I open this and use this key, it will give me the red triangle that I need to unlock the door.
God, I love escape rooms.
The Cybermen allow the Snowcap personnel to contact Zeus 4, but it is too late to save them. The ship is dragged further away from Earth by the new planet and explodes! Fucking harrowing shit.
Intense.
Like, they start smoking and they had to put on their spacesuits and they're, like, looking at each other
it
and you're
feels
like, oh my
like,
god.
Yeah. It feels like that happens later in the episode. Maybe just the two of them in the shuttle made a big impact on
I think
on
it
my brain.
Does, but also the ending is there's a lot going on at once.
Yes.
Yeah, the Cybermen demand information on Earth and explain that Mondas' energy reserves are becoming exhausted. They intend to use all of us. They don't say what energy. Just energy. Just any energy.
Hmm.
Right.
Again, considering with the level of science we've had this story, that actually tracks quite well.
Yeah. It is currently absorbing energy from Earth and will soon destroy it. When Polly asks if they plan to kill all of humankind, the Cybermen reveal they propose to take all humans back to Mondas. Oh, okay, they did plan for the cyber conversion thing.
Cool.
Sort of a confusing element of the plan, I think. Because surely if Mondas is low on resources, the solution is not to have 7 billion more people turn up.
Unless it's low on, like, human resource... people resource.
Yeah, I don't really remember what the population was like in Spare Parts, but it was fairly low, so I guess that would make sense. But also, like...
God, I should have listened to Spare Parts in advance of this episode. Fucking hell, fuckity fuck.
Abe, you said you would, like, fucking 15 years ago.
I will! 15 years!
Yeah. One day you will, and it fucking bangs.
And I'm gonna enjoy it. I'm just very... inconsistent.
Ben, who has been looking for a weapon, rigs up the projector to blind his Cyberman guard. He says, I watched that film 20 years ago, mate. I love him. He baits the Cyberman into the room. After the Cyberman is blinded, he steals the Cyberman's weapon and kills him. He seems to be affected by this death. Yeah, because he's a human
understandably
being.
So.
He doesn't like killing people. He's an able seaman. He doesn't, like, kill people in the Navy. He, like, I don't know.
Loves the
runs
sea.
Around. Like, there wasn't really naval warfare in the 1960s. He's probably been complicit in many deaths, but he hasn't done any murder before.
No, just sat on the sidelines, yeah, singing a little song.
Ben sneaks back into the tracking room and hands the cyber gun to the revived Cutler, who kills the remaining two Cybermen. Cutler contacts Secretary General Wigner at Space Command HQ in Geneva and informs him of the attack. Wigner alerts all military bases and informs them that his son, Lieutenant Terry Cutler, was sent on a mission to rescue the doomed Zeus 4 and in turn is now trapped in orbit. This is like, they're sending, like, it's like the spider to
reasons
catch the
not
fly.
To do nepotism. Your son will get trapped in space.
She swallowed a spider to catch the fly. I don't know why. As Cutler makes plans to secure Snowcap from further Cyberman invasions, including the use of anti-aircraft missiles, the radar technician announces that a fleet of spacecraft have been detected. They are approaching Earth. Fucking baller effect again. There's some great visual design in this serial that I really like.
Yeah.
And of course it reminds me of episode 2 of Blake 7, in which they go, there's 7 ships on our tail! And then they just show an array of 7 dots on the screen. Nowadays, wild. I think they would probably have a CGI insert of the Cybermen ships on the way, but I think this works just as well, possibly better, because then you can imagine the impending threat.
Which is always, theatre of the mind is always a little bit more impactful.
Theatre de la mind. Go on. I don't know what mind is in French.
Great, cool. Today's French lesson. Yep. Episode 3. Apparently suffering from exhaustion, the Doctor collapses and is taken to the crew quarters to rest. Cutler makes contact with Zeus 5. Ben and Polly accompany the Doctor to his quarters. Ben checks his pulse and says he seems fine. Polly remarks that he seems worn out.
The seeds being sown.
It's nearly time. This was not intentional. William Hartnell just had...
Bronchitis.
I want to say tuberculosis, but I knew it wasn't that. No.
Would you believe that in the novelization there's more hints about his impending regeneration?
I'd hope so.
Yeah. He calls Ben and Polly Ian and Barbara on multiple occasions.
Oh! Cutler decides it's time to take the fight to the Cybermen because of course Cutler would.
Yeah, he kind of becomes the villain of the piece in this episode.
Yes. Yeah, he really does.
The Cybermen kind of don't really appear in episode 3, to be honest. They're kind of an incipient
It's a
threat,
very bottle episode.
Had they killed a couple of them by this point? I can't remember. There's a bit where a bunch of them collapse up on the surface. That might be the end of this episode.
I am unsure.
Yeah, I don't remember. Oh, I do want to say, just because I remembered it, I love the little doors that open when they go up to the surface with the snow, because one of the triangles refuses to stay open. It's like the box in Campbell-Wick Green's opening when it opens up, but that one obviously stays open and the one under the ground is not. Oh. This is a box. Musical box. Wound up and ready to
Amazing.
Play. This box can hide a secret inside. Can you guess what is in it today? That's right, it's a Cyberman.
Cutler intends on destroying... Cutler intends on destroying Mondas with a Z-bomb, a series of nuclear bombs that are placed at strategic points around the world. He rings the International Space Center. Secretary Wegener at Geneva refuses permission, but Cutler rephrases his question, asking if he can do anything he deems suitable in order to destroy the Cyberman. Wegener agrees to this, and Cutler... Wegener agrees, and Cutler takes this as permission to use the bomb.
Yeah, this Z-bomb thing.
It's very much the, mom said no, I'll ask dad.
I'm fascinated by the use of the term Z-bomb. It sort of implies that there's been a B-3-Y-bomb in the middle, because the A-bomb is what was written.
The atom bomb.
The atom bomb, and then the H-bomb is the hydrogen bomb, and then the Z-bomb is like the xenon bomb? I don't know.
Xenon spelled with an X, isn't it?
I don't know. The Z-bomb. Okay, it doesn't matter. The Zac Efron bomb, it really doesn't matter. it's clearly just like we've developed so many bombs that now we're all the way down to the Z bomb, and soon we're gonna have to start calling the numbers. Soon we'll have to get out the Greek letters.
It could be the zirconium bomb.
Fantastic.
There we go. There's also or the Zac Efron bomb. Yeah, take your fancy.
The modern equivalent of this in Doctor Who is the Osterhagen key in the Stolen Earth Journey's End, which I would say similarly mixed feelings about conceptually. And also in the new Who one, it's insane that Martha would ever agree to use it, whereas in this one a villain is doing it because it's a bad thing to do.
Yes. Yeah
Like the one in Stolen Earth is going to rip the Earth apart. This one is going to deliver such a huge atomic payload that it will burn half of the Earth essentially.
Yeah, it's like the cost is significantly higher than Ben and Polly argue against using this bomb because they are sensible human beings.
Yes, with compassion.
Ben says the Doctor believed that Mondas will destroy itself anyway when it absorbs too much energy. Cutler does not appreciate this intervention and confines Ben to the same quarters in which the Doctor's resting. Before he leaves, he implores Polly to try to convince Barclay to call off the attack. When Ben arrives in the quarters, he tries to rouse the Doctor to no avail. However, he soon finds a vent that he begins to loosen with his penknife because
Ben.
He has initiative.
Action Ben. He's an action man. Action Ben. I love him.
Yes.
I love everything about him. I watched the Twice Upon a Time clips of the 10th Planet recreation. Mm-hmm. The guy they cast as Ben looks nothing like him. It's so funny. They've given him brown hair.
But he's a little mousy boy.
It's insane. Like, they clearly didn't spend that much money on it, but surely they could have hired a blonde extra.
Dyson and Cutler fuse the bomb. Cutler admits he is scared by what he is about to do, but feels that he has no choice. When he returns to the control center, he is concerned to hear that they have lost contact with Zeus 5. Polly talks to Barclay, who admits he is reluctant to launch the bomb, citing the radiation caused by the exploding planet, which would cause great loss of life on Earth. Polly suggests they rig the bomb so it doesn't explode. Their plans are because she's great, yeah. Their plans are interrupted by Cutler, who explains they are to wait for the Cybermen to land, and then they will destroy them with their own weapons. Barclay and Polly sneak away to find Ben. Barclay explains that he would need to go through the vent to reach the bomb and tells Ben how to sabotage the rocket to prevent it from reaching Mondas. As Ben leaves, the alarm to signal the arrival of the Cybermen sounds.
I like that they already have a specific
very intense
alarm.
I imagine it's just their intense threat, and this is just the intense threat.
But also,
that
it's nice to imagine that the guy who does their alarms is put a little bit of paper with a sharpie just written Cyberman alarm.
The Cybermen land and are immediately mowed down by the hidden soldiers wielding the Cybermen's weapons. The soldiers collect the incapacitated Cybermen's weapons for the next assault. Ben has reached the bomb and begins the process of disarming it. But at the control center, Cutler notices Barclay's absence. He goes to investigate, catches Ben while he's sabotaging the rocket, and knocks him unconscious.
He throws him over a fucking railing, like an indeterminate distance to the ground.
Really intense.
Ben could have died. He could have fucking died.
That would have been a really dark way for them to go.
Yeah, I just mean it like in real life. Don't do this. He fell backwards over a railing. Like, he definitely got very concussed. He got turbo concussed.
Zed concussion.
Yes. Zed cars, Zed concussion, Zed bomb. They're all linked. Connected the dots! Zed cars, Zed bomb. I've got a string between the two of them.
Later, Barclay starts the countdown for the launch of the Zed bomb. Ben regains consciousness but is disoriented and cannot remember if he sabotaged the rocket before being discovered by Cutler. The countdown approaches zero.
Fucking baller shit. Like, it starts being displayed on the screen, as we mentioned.
Good.
So cool.
Really, sort of, really intense.
Also, I like Barclay sort of emergence as like a sort of semi-heroic character in this episode, because he's sort of been around being the science guy, and I like that he gets to like have a more of a backbone in this episode and kind of go, you know what, we are going to solve this. Yeah.
I can't actually remember what he looks like because a week has passed since I watched this.
He's got a little beard.
So in my head I'm just imagining...
He has gay vibes.
Oh. I'm just imagining Barclay from Star Trek, who also has gay vibes.
Nice.
Episode four.
Yeah, episode three is just good. Like, it's kind of like a setup episode for episode four in a way. And I will confess that I was playing Animal Crossing while I was watching the latter half of this because I needed to check on my island.
Episode four.
AIM would like to note that before the episode started, their DVD player went drr, as if it was also going to blast off into space. Is that the noise that it made?
Yeah, pretty spot on.
Yeah, I'm good at reading noises.
I think it's because changing from... You've developed the skill. I think it's because this is when we switch from live action to animation.
It is when we switch to animation, because the fourth episode...
I think that's what my DVD was
saying. The fourth episode is sadly lost to the sounds of time. It may one day reappear or it may not. But yeah, so as the countdown to launch the Z-bomb reaches zero, the engines fail on the launch pad. Ben did it! Yeah!
Gasp! Yes!
Cutler is enraged. Yeah, he's properly off the deep end this episode.
It's not a happy bunny.
He threatens to kill Ben, Barclay and the Doctor, who has regained consciousness and returned to the tracking room. Driven mad with grief by the apparent death of his son in the Zeus 5 rescue capsule, Cutler is oblivious to the warnings that another force of Cybermen are attacking the base. He also ignores the Doctor's protestations that Mondas is on the verge of burning up. I really like the animated cutaways to the Mondas thing on the monitor. I think they've really sort of replicated what was going on originally, but made it even more dramatic with this sort of like glowing outline behind it. And like, you know, there's just more dimension to it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the joys of having the animations. They can go a bit
further.
I do
really want to know what it originally looked like when it blew up, though.
Oh, boy.
Like, did they just blow it up? I want to know. Did they blow a balloon inside it and let it crack? I must know.
One day we will find the answer.
As he is about to carry out his threat and kill the Doctor, Cutler is killed by the invading Cybermen. The Doctor tries to mediate with the Cybermen, offering them a home on Earth to replace their broken up planet. The Cybermen say that they will not even think about negotiations with a missile pointed at the planet and demand that it be removed before they begin negotiations.
I don't think I can blame them for that either.
As a makeweight, a phrase I've never heard before, they take Polly as prisoner onto their ship. And then she's vanished for the episode. I assume Malika Wolf's went on holiday or something, I don't know.
On holiday?
As soon as they arrive at their ship, the Cybermen render Polly unconscious and place her in a large metal chair, where she will remain for the rest of the episode.
For the rest of the story.
The Doctor takes charge of the control centre and contacts the International Space Centre, who themselves have been taken over by Cybermen, to tell them of the situation. Classic. I sort of forgot that Cybermen had got like left the South Pole and also gone other places. I guess that's the nature of the invasion force, the fleet. That's the word. The Cybermen in Geneva contact the Cyberman at Snowcap and informs him that they must move to their secondary objective, which the Doctor assumes to be the destruction of Earth. The Doctor goes on the loudspeaker system.
Again, very fair assumption.
Yeah, the Doctor goes on the loudspeaker system and warns all of Snowcap of this. Classic. He's like, hello everybody, just so you know, they're going to try and blow us up. Don't let them, ?
Bye.
Down in the pit of the Z-bomb, Ben, Barclay, Haynes and Dyson, I don't know who Haynes is, Haynes and Dyson are disarming the bomb. Ben raises the question as to why the Cybermen are not doing this themselves, what with them being naturally stronger. Also, they're all wearing the most heinous radiation suits. They're so unconvincing. It's just basically a poncho over their head. Ben, very, very, very clever thinking of this, going, hey, hang on, why aren't they doing this?
Why are we
this? Obviously, we're the drudges, technically, but also, like, they could do this and they wouldn't have to rely on us not betraying them, which they're going to do. What with them being naturally stronger? Yeah, Ben hypothesizes that they are intolerant to the radiation in the bomb. Good thought, Ben. Dyson, Haynes, Barclay and Ben put this to the test by playing dead and drawing in the Cyberman guard from outside, who immediately is rendered immobile. Hell yeah. I love when he's like, play dead, everyone. And then Barclay's like, yeah, everyone, get on the ground. Reminds me of Susan going, I'll be the body in Marinus and lying directly on the floor. Lots of willingness to be silly. I enjoy it.
In this show?
Yeah. Ben uses his knowledge to order the return of Polly, because he's in love with her. However, the Cybermen refuse to relent. The Doctor is now taken to the Cyber Ship. Once again, I love Cyber as a prefix. We've discussed this before. However, the Cybermen warn Ben that both he and Polly will be killed unless they give up the bomb. Ben looks around for something in the room that is portable and radioactive that they can use to their advantage. Radiation sickness doesn't exist in 1986. Sorry.
No, I mean, it does. Again, they're wearing suits, and it's very consistent with the episode's scientific
Thank you, Kit
creativity.
Pedler. He's not a nuclear physicist, as far as I'm aware, so, you know.
Neither am I.
Wow, 3 for 3.
You know what they say, glass houses throwing stones.
Glass stones throwing houses, yeah.
Yeah, I know.
With the help of Barclay and Dyson, he uncouples something from the back of one of the computers he can use for this purpose. It's a reactor rod of some kind, I think. It's basically what Homer accidentally, like, throws onto his back in the Simpsons intro. Like, one of those.
Yeah, the little rod holdy thing.
They hide behind the door as the Cybermen approach. The Cybermen attempt to gas the four men out. When Ben and the Wren can't... Ben and the Wren?
When... Ben and the Wren, my new poem. There was a man named Ben. He saw a little wren. It flapped away and flapped away. It was never seen again.
Beautiful, beautiful. I'm nominating Thank it you, for the White Review Prize. When Ben and the rest cannot take any more, they open the door and use a combination of the deactivated Cyberman's gun and the radioactive equipment to deactivate the Cybermen. However, Haynes is killed. Lots of high body count in this serial, I would say. On returning to the control base of Snowcap, Barclay shows Ben a device that the Cybermen use to contact each other. Ben uses it randomly to draw the Cybermen in. Whilst they wait, the lights dim as Mondas draws yet more power from Earth. As the Cybermen approach, one of the scientists points to the screen where they see Mondas flash brightly and melt. The Cybermen that were approaching the humans disintegrate as the power source they had drawn from has been removed, TARDIS Wiki! Why would you use this word?
Well, which one? Where are we?
The power source they had drawn from. That one. I know what it means.
Oh my god.
I know what it means, but we're not using it. So if you want to know what word I'm avoiding using, you can look at the TARDIS Wiki summary for episode 4 of The Tenth Planet.
Unless I go in and change it.
Zeus 5 returns on screen. Its pilot explains that all power has been restored and he can attempt re-entry. So yeah, the effect of Mondas exploding is so good. So fucking good. Also, some people count this as one of the Doctor's genocides, and I would actually argue that Mondas did this to itself.
Go on.
Well, just in the sense that, like, they could have stopped at any time. They knew that this... Surely they would have known that this could happen. They would have gone, hang on, something's wrong right now. We need to let go of this energy. But instead, they didn't. Yeah, so I would argue that this is Mondas' fault.
That's very fair. And I think the other thing is the Doctor isn't massively active in this story.
Like, the
either.
Doctor doesn't do
the
anything.
Doctor's
you
choices
could easily
aren't...
accuse just like, you know, the Cybermen were going to steal all the humans and cyberconvert them. They were going to do a genocide. So the options were be the victim of genocide or let a planet explode. It's not like it's Alderaan where the Death Star deliberately shoots it and it explodes. It's a different kind of process, I would argue. Feel free to fight me on Twitter, listeners.
Are you sure you want to invite this?
Ben runs out to the cybership to free Polly and a semi-conscious Doctor, and he and Polly hug, and it's really cute. I love them so much.
It's very sweet.
The Doctor seems to deliberate as to whether it's all over before settling that it's far from being all over. This is one of the...
God, it's so cryptic.
This is one of the clips that survives because of home video, so thank God, because it's good. And alerting his companions that he must return to the TARDIS immediately. Ben gives him his cloak so he won't catch his death of cold, but the Doctor gives him an unusually distant reply, concerned with something more important at hand. Bearing little attention to Ben or Polly, he even deserts them, rushing off alone. The weary Doctor returns to the TARDIS and closes the door, trying to take care of a dire situation by himself. He wants his companions safely away from him when a particular event happens, but they are protesting for him to let them inside anyway. As Ben and Polly hammer on the door, the controls operate of their own accord and the central column begins to rise and fall. The Doctor seizes enough energy to open the door, and Ben and Polly finally get in. Barely conscious, the Doctor collapses to the floor. Ben and Polly stand back as the Doctor becomes enveloped in a bright light. After the light dies down, the Doctor's face is different and has the appearance of a younger, dark-haired man.
To remain in this universe, the creature would have to reverse its polarity.
Whoa, what's this crazy
Very good.
Happenstance that's occurred? We've never seen this happen before on the podcast.
Never seen this.
It's our first regeneration.
It's so exciting. It's our first regeneration.
Yeah, because...
I was thinking about this last week, but I've thought about other things since then.
Twin Dilemma, but he doesn't regenerate on screen in the Twin Dilemma. It's a post-regeneration story. This is our first regeneration story.
Yeah, we're the first Doctor, we haven't done regen stories. That's exciting. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, Jesus Christ.
I think it's also great to have the first regeneration as our first regeneration.
Yeah,
because
thank you, random number generator.
Hey, it has our best interests
in
heart.
It really does.
As a concept for keeping the show running, it's what was done effectively by necessity has ended up being the thing that has given the show the most longevity.
Yeah.
The show would not be able to function without the regeneration gimmick.
It is pretty fascinating. Like, the fact that they did it out of, as you say, necessity, and they were like, well, we don't want to stop making the show, but William Hartnell is too ill to keep doing it.
But it could also have not worked.
It could have not worked. Patrick
the wrong
Trump
actor could have ruined the entire show, and we would not be making this show
Patrick
right now.
Trump went for it, and we are very thankful to him.
Yeah, I think that we've talked about our love for two and the importance of
having
him be distinct from the First Doctor to make it successful.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah. It's kind of sad that, again, because of William Hartnell's ill health, he's so unpresent throughout most of his final story as well.
Yeah, he's very distant. He's ill. He's not given a lot to do.
When he's there, he's great.
Yeah, he's definitely on like his final top form. And then when he comes back in Three Doctors, he's definitely not very well.
In his shed, bless him.
But, you know, he came back for a little bit. And that was lovely that he got to come back.
An apple a day keeps the... No, never mind.
Yeah, when he's hit, especially in the first two episodes, he is just having a delightful time. Yeah. I think he enjoys being a nuisance.
Yeah, he loves to cause, as we say, he loves to cause and solve problems on purpose. The problems are usually smaller scale than an invasion of Cybermen, which is what people are accusing him of. It's just difficult to talk about one in this story because, as we say, he doesn't get to do a lot. The previous story was The Smugglers, which is missing. So I don't know what his energy levels were like in that. But it's clear that he's sort of, he's top. Episode 4, he just seems quite tired. And I know that's partly the character, but it must also...
Yeah, and partly also he's recovering from bronchitis.
I know how that feels.
Oh, babe.
Yeah, the showmanship of writing down what they're going to see on the monitor was very, like, magician kind of thing, which I enjoyed a lot, thinking about him as, like, a space magician. Mm. And I love, why don't you speak up, I'm deaf, or I don't like your tone, sir. Like, he's so grumpy, and I love him so much.
Mm. He's almost got similar energy to what he had in his first episode as well. There's a nice little roundedness to how he is in Unearthly Child. Don't have massive amounts to say about him other than I wish he'd had more ability to be more present for his final story.
Yeah, it is a shame. And I like his acting in the regeneration scene because he looks very ill. You're like, how much of this is acting and how much of it is real? But like the sort of, it's far from being all over, the, you know, keep warm being his last words. And you're like, oh my God, Doctor. Oh, it's like the journey that this character has come on from an unearthly child to the 10th planet is so fascinating.
Yeah, there's the openness that
the willingness to be kind to other people that who aren't his grandson, his grandchild.
It's good.
I have to go.
Now look, if you're going to be in trouble, you'll need me to look after you.
Me too.
But right. You don't understand.
So Polly is just a delight. We've mentioned her complimenting the TARDIS wardrobe and say, where do you shop? Carnaby Street.
It's delightful. It's very cute. And let's note that Ben is wearing a turtleneck with a jumper on top.
Yeah, have noted that. It's exactly what I wore at the age of 16.
It's what I wear to work.
So it's very good. There's also a little bit where Polly offers to help and says, I can make coffee or something. And it's like, my darling, you can do so much more than make coffee or something. Coffee is very important, however.
Polly's ongoing crisis of self-confidence is so sad because the episodes keep going, oh, she'll go make coffee. And then what she'll actually do is suggest the thing that defeats the monster. Like, she has no self-confidence. It's like, no, Polly, you're fantastic.
Yeah, she's fantastic. I wish she loved herself as much as I love her.
I hope she gets better at it by the time we get to the faceless ones. I haven't seen the faceless ones yet, so I don't know.
No, me neither.
I like that she pulled out the geography level to identify Malaysia before anything else. I'm like, of all of the countries to first identify, when South America is scrolling by on screen upside down, she recognises upside down Malaysia.
Maybe that is just something she was fixated with at the age of 16.
Maybe her dad was in Malaysia in the war or something, I don't know. I should note, when the Cybermen arrive, Polly screams, very justified, because they're fucking horrified.
Same. Yeah, they are not friends,
not shaped like buddies. And then she still runs up to it to shout about empathy. I am in love with her. She is so brave to the point of foolhardiness. I love the spine that she has.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh. She is just the best.
Continuing to argue with the Cybermen just because she cares so much about people. That's the point, really, isn't it? Any Cyberman story, the counterance always has to be, but people matter, but individuality matters.
The bit where she says, but they're going to die, don't you care? And he goes, care? Why should I care? It's just, she just doesn't understand it. And I think it's a really good demonstration of the fundamental difference with the Cybermen. It's not that they look different or that they have cybernetic implants. It's that they don't feel things anymore.
It's
not good. It's not good. And as I say, I feel like she's actually got quite a sneaky personality, which I enjoy. She's a schemer. She concocts schemes and theories and stuff. Like when she had the chemical composition acetone solvent thing in the moon base, and in here when she theorizes about getting rid of the bomb and all this other stuff. Like, she's very sneaky and I love her. Also in The Five Companions, when she whacks a Sontaran with her stiletto heel. That's also very good.
That's iconic. Very good. Very
also, the wife note is just, Mamma mia, bellissima! Indeed! Look at her. She's wearing such a cute outfit in the snow. She's got a little, like, Russian cap and a muffle. Like, a muff. Like, what's it called when it's around your hands? The thing? The muffler? Whatever it is.
Anyway,
she's putting her hands in it. And it's not a very... None of them are wearing the most practical outfit for the Antarctic, but it's what the BBC wardrobe had. So...
Yep. We also love Ben.
Yeah, we do also love Ben.
It's great. I love loving people.
He's just great. We've talked about most of the things here, but he's just wonderful. And we've already talked on the moon base and also in Power of the Daleks. We really like having a working class companion who is allowed to sound working class and use, like, vocabulary that he would use. Obviously, it's partly written by Kit Padlow, who is not working class. So some of it's a little bit, like...
forced.
Yeah, but you know, it's good. It's good to have Ben, and he calls, you know, he's calling people geezer. Matt, just imagine trying to attack one of them geezers with a screwdriver when he's trying to figure out what he's doing in the projector room.
So good.
And when the Cyberman ties a gun into a knot and he goes, blimey!
I think I like that you've added Ben and Polly as a duo onto this list.
Well, yeah, because similar to how we love Ben, you know who else loves Ben? It's Polly.
Polly! Right? Yeah. Is the first Doctor of the era where we get the highest ratio of companions in love with each other.
But yeah, speaking of Ben and Polly, they're just very cute when they're all dressing up and he goes, what do you think you are, Nanook of the North or something?
It's adorable.
Very cute. Nanook of the North, for the record, is a controversial documentary in quotation marks about us Inuits, which reinforced a lot of stereotypes that didn't actually exist, because it was not actually an ethnographic documentary, it was a fictional film, essentially.
From 1922.
It did remind me of my current reading obsession, which is Noggin the Nog, because Noggin the Nog's wife is called Nuka. she is from Nuka's daughter of Nuuk of whatever their tribe is called. The Land of the Midnight Sun, pardon me. Noggin the Nog, by the way, listeners. If you're looking for books that get inexplicably racist in their third part, you'd really love Noggin the Nog.
Niche, but I'm sure someone will appreciate it.
Well, you know, because I was watching Ivan the Engine, and then I was like, well, I want to read Noggin the Nog. And luckily, I have all the Noggin the Nog books, because my grandma gave them to me. I have lent one of them to a child at a school that I'm not going back to for a while, so I'll get that back eventually.
Eventually.
I won't be able to reread The Island for some time, which is a shame, because it's one of Nogbad's better schemes, I would say. Compared to his scheme in a recent book, which I read... which is called The Game, where Olaf the Lofty invents chess, essentially, or Hneffentafel, or whatever. And Nogbad is like, my scheme is to train some bears and put them in troll costumes and then scare Noggin the Nog. And it's like, how is this in any way going to get you the crown, Nogbad? Let me just pin this as... let me just, like, clap so I know when to cut my Noggin the Nog diatribe. So now I'm going to cut it and we can go back to talking about what we were talking about.
Ben and Polly are in love.
They are in love. They're so cute. Come back, Polly. They'll blow your head off. And then he, like, grabs her by the arm and is like, no, don't leave me. I love you.
It's very cute.
He calls her Duchess. And then he calls her... Then when they hug, he calls her love. And you're like, oh, my God. Like, obviously, that's a thing people say. Like, especially in Britain. It's, like, a common endearment. But
we
also...
just call people love.
Yeah. We know that Ben is in love with Polly. We know this. So...
do I call people I love more than people I don't love? Yes. But that's mostly because I'm more likely to be talking to somebody I love.
And then I accidentally wrote the Arctic.
So I came on to add some notes this morning, saw the Arctic had been added.
In the companion section.
The noise I made was very Of course, fucking course, you added the Arctic itself as a character.
I meant to write the crew, but I couldn't think of a phrasing, and then I had to go...
I don't think you did.
I can't remember what I was going
to I think you just wanted to talk about the cold lands.
Yeah, I mean, the Antarctic is definitely a thing to talk about, and believe me, I've been thinking about something that I will be discussing during critique. I hope you're excited.
I'm raising my eyebrows in anticipation.
Yeah, it's going to be great. I meant to write the Antarctic crew, like the crew of the base, as sort of a companion light situation, like Barclay is sort of ends up being Ben and Polly's companion. But instead you've said that we should talk about the Arctic itself as a character and pathetic fallacy and stuff. So the Antarctic is very cold.
It's an interesting place. They could have put the space anywhere for the intents of the story, but choosing to have it somewhere so isolated already adds to like a story where the threat is an isolated world, isolated from emotion species.
Yeah,
I think it adds to the themes of isolation.
Yeah, it definitely is.
And
like,
the level of threat is there before you even get any aliens.
Like the base is this like nucleus of humanity in a completely dead wasteland, and then the Cybermen come in and try and annihilate it, and you're like, oh okay. It's sort of like a metaphor for the Earth versus Mondas, because Earth is like a nucleus of humanity in the middle of a massive dead wasteland, aka space. Not that that's how it works in most of Doctor Who. I was just reminded, you know, they're releasing Ernest Shackleton's voyage, like, footage that was made as a documentary.
Yeah.
That sounds, like, I looked at it and I was really overcome by seeing Ernest Shackleton's face, like, moving and talking. Obviously, you can't hear it, but, like, really verklempt, I would say.
Exciting. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, it's going to be cool. It wasn't a totally unsuccessful mission, unlike the Franklin expedition, so.
Oh, boy.
The Arctic is cold, and the Antarctic is cold. It's very cold.
Like the Cybermen's hearts.
Unlike Tiddy, which is soft and warm.
A woman!
Unfortunately, we're not breaking onto that one. We're breaking into...
On your knees, Doctor.
We've got quite a few points here, which is always nice.
Yeah, although some of them are quite brief, I would say.
The inherent homoeroticism of an Antarctic base, etc., etc.
Did you... Abe, have you heard of this one movie? I don't know if you've heard of it.
Go on, tell me about it. Go on.
It's often considered a cult classic, and it was a big flop at the box office because it was released opposite E.T. But you might have...
Some of my favourite films are like that.
You might have heard of John Carpenter's Passion Project, which... He was given all this money, and they were like, hey, can you remake this thing that was based on Joseph Campbell's Who Goes There? And he goes, yes, of course, I can make that. And he made a really good film called The Thing, 1982.
The Thing. It's not a very catchy title, is it?
No, I know. The Thing, 1982. It doesn't stick in your head. Unlike The Thing from Another World, 1954, whenever that came out.
Yeah, I should have used that instead. No, never heard of it.
No, I know. I so rarely mention how much I love that movie. But yeah, the inherent homoeroticism of Antarctic bases. It's all these men living in close proximity. At one point in the background, there's two guys sat on the same bunk messing about with some musical instruments or something. And I was like, those guys have explored each other's bodies.
They're in love. Yeah. Almost thought that the guy with all of the pictures of model pinups was overperforming heterosexuality.
Yeah. He's performing heterosexuality like it's his damn job, because when Polly actually appears, he doesn't seem that interested in her. Like when she's there,
so
in
me
person.
Age 17.
He's great. Tito will be sorely missed after being killed by some Cybermen. General Cutler and One do have a homoerotically charged enmity, because they're just shouting at each other, very impassioned. And obviously One doesn't get a lot of chances to be impassioned this serial, except when he's shouting at Cutler or at the Cybermen. So
Cutler's got to put that energy into something. Indeed. Or someone.
I guess we're assuming that One is the bottom in this situation, but I'm not sure.
I think One has bottom energy.
I think One has T-boy swag. Have we ever talked about this?
We have not.
I think that One has a transmasculine energy to him. I can't explain this. I think it's just because the Doctor has a transmasculine energy.
Yes. In every iteration.
In every iteration. Like 13 is sort of a non-binary trans mask with like gender fluidity and stuff. Like when she's wearing the tux and you're like, T-boy swag. That's what that is.
Yeah. Who is the most cis aligned gender?
I love 10, but it's 10. Because they made him the most heterosexual Doctor. And he also...
Yeah, rewatching 10 at the moment. Yeah, I guess they did.
Like, coincidentally, he's just also has a very cis vibe, because they were doing, like, canonical like he's making out with women and stuff, so they can't have him have T-boy swag because that would be queer. Even though it's RTD, I just don't get it. Like, why did you make him so straight? Why'd you do it?
There are a few throwaway lines, but there's nothing as explicit as we see with female characters. You're right.
It's sad. Come on, RTD. RTD 2, you gotta give us the T-boy swag. I think they should cast a trans actor as the Doctor. That's just what I think.
That would be very good.
Because if the Doctor regenerates into a trans body, people are going to have such fucking hysterics because they seem to think that the Doctor regenerates like he's being born like a baby.
I imagine you've seen all over Twitter people calling for Abigail Thorne to be the Doctor.
Yeah, I mean,
she'd obviously smash it. She was, I mean, I don't know if she would go for it given the chance, but she would smash it out
she
the park.
She absolutely would. I watched a very small clip of a TV show I have no interest in solely because Abigail Thorne was in it. She was playing nice. Like a grown up. It was like a time skip thing where it was about this guy's childhood and his adulthood, and one of his friends transitioned, and he was very confused, and she was like, "Dude, I'm literally right here. Can you please call me by my name? Bastard."
Nice.
But yeah, also Ben X, the American guy getting chummy over moon landings. He seemed like, yeah, patrol just returned. Like, oh, it's cute. It's cute. Unfortunately, the American guy dies immediately. Bury your gaze, question mark.
Big question mark. Schultz and Williams, yes, I also think.
I think that there's no way that you can train together that long to go on a space expedition and not explore one another's bodies. This is why every character in The Martian has slept together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just being locked in a small capsule to do an atmosphere pressure test and not having the urge to do a little kiss.
Just a little one. I like to think, just and a this little is mostly one. Because I wasn't really paying attention because it was upsetting. I like to think they held hands as they died. Like Ozuras and Grantaire.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a very serious scene. It's very sad. And I'm like, man, I hope they just had one last spark of loveliness before they exploded.
It's all any of us can ask
yeah,
for.
It should be noted, though, that Earl Cameron is, by about a factor of 7,000, a better actor than the guy playing the Australian guy. Not least because he's being forced to do an Australian accent when he's clearly not Australian. I'm loving this note from Joel.
Joel, I was typing away some notes in the living room earlier, and Joel just comes in and says, "Are you going to say that the Cybermen look like gimps?"
I don't think they do, because their mouths are open.
But there's definitely some energy there with, like, the flatness of the mouths.
I guess.
The faces.
I think more when they're animated. Also, when they're animated, the eyes are lower down their face for some reason, which really freaks me out.
Just to make them worse.
Just to make them somehow worse, yeah. Because the mouths aren't constantly open in the animation with, like, horrible black holes. It's just that the eyes are lower down, like their cheek eyes.
I just had my mouth open like a Cyberman, but you cannot see me.
You
so that was
cannot
for the benefit
see
of my microphone.
My mouth open like a Cyberman.
And it is a tragedy.
As you can tell, listeners, it's very hard to talk like a Roy Skelton Cyberman. Like, I can do, like, just a general, like, Cyberman, like, "You will be like us." Like, I can do that, but I can't do Roy Skelton.
But when it becomes like this,
I think we have too much expression in it. It has to be sing-song, but without any emotion whatsoever. And we start laughing immediately, so. Yeah, and Barkley does have confirmed bachelor vibe. Like, look at him.
Mm-hmm.
He's a homosexual.
That is the only explanation.
Yes. It's 1986. It's after Decrim. He's probably got a boyfriend at home, and he's going to return to him and go, "You will not fucking believe what just happened." I like him. I want a short trip about him and his husband now.
Mm-hmm. That would be adorable.
Yeah.
Write it.
Ben and Polly, like, run into him, and that he's like, "Why are you 20 years older?" And they're like, "Well, the thing is, we went to the past," and he goes, "Oh, okay, say no more."
"You're one of these television chaps, then?"
I am no sort of chap, sir.
I just want to once again talk about gender and the Cybermen, because what the fuck is going on with gender in the Cybermen? They never at any point have sexual dimorphism until the new series. And even in the new, like I say the new series, until Torchwood. Because then in the new series, when they're like doing Age of Steel and stuff, all the Cybermen look exactly the same. So it's completely reasonable to suspect that these Cybermen are in fact converted from women. Because in Spare Parts, they explain it that all jobs have the suffix man. So, like, one of the characters is called Sister Man Constance because she's, like, a nun. And the Cybermen have names like Cyberman Eric or whatever because it's, like, it's their role. But at the time, they had not created that little bit of no-price continuity. So, like, what's the gender situation? Have they only converted the men and all the women are hiding back on Mondas? As it says in
the
Science of
way
Doctor
around.
Who on page 104... it seems likely that these ruthless cyborgs would have no ethical qualms whatsoever over modifying their young from the earliest possible age, particularly if that meant that the results would be better. Yeah. Basically, it says that babies would be better able to adapt to cybernetic implants. So, much to think about there. Thank you, The Science of Doctor Who by Paul Parsons.
I don't enjoy the thought of converting babies into cybernetic.
No, but it's almost definitely come up in some horrible expanded media.
Yep. And we'll definitely discover it before we're done watching every episode of this show.
Yay!
Today's science fiction so often becomes tomorrow's science fact.
William Hartnell failed to arrive to the rehearsal for episode 3, as we've mentioned, informing the production team that he was ill with bronchitis. Story editor Jerry Davis rewrote the script so the Doctor is unconscious for the entire episode and can only be seen briefly from behind, played by the double, with most of the dialogue going to Ben.
Yeah, he just fully collapses.
Ben and Polly, but mostly Ben. Yeah. It's quite intense. But after filming the last few scenes of this story, the principal cast and members of the production team attended a farewell party for William Hartnell at Innes Lloyd's Flat, which is very nice of them.
Thanks, Innes Lloyd.
Yeah. Got a bit of stuff around William Hartnell leaving as well. Interviewed in 1991, Annika Wills says, as you've probably heard from other people, Bill Hartnell was a very tricky character, very, very tricky. So the rest of the cast would stick together and have sort of a reality check. His departure was all pretty emotional and rather difficult.
Yeah.
Which I can imagine.
There's sort of a question as to whether he left or was sort of forced out.
Push. Yeah, I've got some quotes from William Hartnell about leaving, which add a few different shades to that question. From the press release at the BBC when it was announced he'd be leaving in August 1966. I think 3 years in one part is good innings and is a time for change. It is time for change. In a 1968 letter to a fan, basically, I left Doctor Who because we did not see eye to eye over the stories, and too much evil entered the spirit of the thing. Doctor Who was always noted and spelled out to me as a children's programme, and I wanted it to stay as such, but I'm afraid the BBC had other ideas. So did I, so I left. I didn't willingly give up the part. A year later, an interview in 1969. It's a long time ago now, and I think my hurt has healed, although I must say the events of those last few months are engraved on my heart. Which sounds, yeah, emotional. In a newspaper interview in 1970, I was upset at coming out of Doctor Who, but I didn't agree with what was happening to him. There's too much violence creeping into the series. It's too adult. It's meant for children, not grown-ups. There are lots of things you could learn from it. There are lots of things you could learn from it now to start a major war. I've stopped watching, so have a lot of children, that's what I hear. They all keep saying to me, when are you coming back? But it's also different now. So I think that's more how he explained it to himself and the narrative he built up around it. As opposed to the whole truth, but it's definitely an element of the truth.
Yeah, there's also some speculation that Jerry Davis was like, we need to change something because no one is watching the show anymore. Which is certainly an interesting take. I'm looking on the Doctor Who Cuttings archive and there's a bit that says, I see ABC Television is planning a new space fiction series to challenge Doctor Who. I wish it would aim its challenge a little higher. It's about time someone said quite loudly that the only thing that stops Doctor Who being a thundering bore is that it is too feeble to thunder.
Ooh. Ooh.
Thank you, Newcastle Journal. Yeah, I don't know what this ITV space show was going to be, but it was apparently being developed in 1966 by ITV. Don't know what it would
interesting.
Be. Also, it was going to be, he had a contract that was due for renewal in November but decided not to renew it, so that's another part of it. A friend said last night, it has been a great strain for William over the last 3 years. The serial demands a great deal from him as an actor. He has often said he would like to leave and return to the theatre. A friend sounds like perhaps Jerry Davis in a trench coat. yeah, it's all quite interesting to see what's going on with it, I guess.
And again, we are 50 years in the future from it, and we have seen what happened with the show and what happened with him.
Yeah. So, you know, it is sad for him because obviously, like, he wanted to do it forever. But also, I think saying it was getting evil is a little bit much, William.
Yeah, saying you could learn things to start a major world war.
The whole point is that the fight
might be hyperbolic.
It. The whole point is you're fighting against the war.
Yeah. And it's also, I think, to say it was getting too adult really underestimates the capacity of children to understand and engage with complex topics.
Yeah, especially because the second...
Which is the most dangerous thing you can do.
The second story they ever did was about a post-nuclear apocalyptic planet full of a race that literally wanted to annihilate the other inhabitants of the planet again.
From my perspective, seeing how people explain these things to themselves as they go through it.
Especially
is very, always
those
interesting.
Quotes are over the course of about 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. All right. Moving on. One reason for introducing the Cybermen was the prospect of losing the rights to the Daleks, which is interesting. That was, again, as Terry Nation was pitching his Dalek show, which never happened.
Yeah, I still don't know what would have happened with that. Like, were the Daleks going to be the main characters? No, so why make it a Dalek show?
I don't know, maybe it would have been Mr. and Mrs. Dalek.
Sarah Kingdom was going to be the main character.
Oh, interesting. This is one that you've added.
Yes.
Do you
want
to read it?
Did you know that this story... Oh, sorry, a different one. The film the projector starts playing that Ben says he saw 20 years ago was Wagon Wheels, 1943. This was in the IMDb Connection section. Wounded while stopping the James gang from robbing the local bank, a cowboy wakes up in the hospital to find that he's been elected town marshal. Whoa! He soon comes into conflict with the town banker who controls everything in town and is squeezing the townspeople for every penny he can get out of them. Capitalism bad, the movie. I haven't seen it. I just thought it was fun. It was a real movie and not just like stock footage.
That's very cute. Yeah.
Apparently in the book, they change it to be a James Bond film, which is implied to be... which one was it?
Spyfall?
No, not... yes, famous James Bond film, Spyfall. It was implied to be The Man with the Golden Gun, which I've not seen, but it had Roger Moore in it.
Yeah. And you've added another point here.
Yes, did you know that this story was partially inspired by Howard Hawks' 1953 adaptation of The Thing from Another World?
I'm not surprised.
No, and I can't remember where I heard this.
I'm also not surprised
also,
that you're mentioning it.
Also, it seems extremely obvious when you actually have seen both. Also, this is way better than The Thing from Another World because things happen in it. Unlike The Thing from Another World, where the fucking thing doesn't even show up until like 50 minutes into an hour and 15 minute long movie. And also, it's a giant carrot, essentially.
This is why the John Carpenter version is better.
Yeah, the John Carpenter version.
Because it shows up and there's a dog with nothing wrong with it.
Nothing wrong at all. And it is the,
nothing
it is
wrong.
The
very
best
good
version of the story, including the original novella, which is just kind of boring. No matter how cool the description of the thing is to begin with, where it's got like blue tentacles and a big red eye or whatever.
We all have that.
Yeah, no, it's just... Why would they even mention it? But yeah, I just thought that was interesting, especially thinking about the Cybermen as an iteration of the thing, which is like this threat to your very humanity. Mm. Assimilation and conversion into something that is completely unfamiliar to yourself while still technically being yourself. Kind of some parallels. Which is also
very,
why I just
wanted
to quickly mention how I think this movie would be... How I think this series will be improved by replacing the entire crew with the cast of the thing. Just the same, but one Polly and Ben show up.
I would really enjoy that.
It's the Cybermen, and that might be a fic that I write. I'm not going to lie to you because I think it'll be fun.
I think you are going to write it. I just have, you know how sometimes you just get a gut feeling about something.
I'm just imagining Ben swearing so hard at all of them. I think Ben should have been allowed to say fuck.
Yeah, he deserves it.
But yeah, that was just a little thing that I knew about the thing from Another World and the Tenth Planet. I think it might have come up in Inside the TARDIS, the Worlds of Doctor Who, but it's been a while since I actually read that segment, and currently I'm trying to search through Inside the TARDIS, the Worlds of Doctor Who.
And it's going well.
It's going so well. But yeah, basically, it just has a couple of things where they talk about the difference between Cybermen and humans, and then there's some quotes from them. Sort of the physical differences, but not really a lot of new content from Inside the TARDIS, the Worlds of Doctor Who.
Cool. As we've discussed, it's the first time the regeneration process is seen, but it's not named until Planet of the Spiders in 1974.
Yeah, before that it's sort of referred to as like a rejuvenation or a...
If it's referred to at all.
Yeah, if it's referred to at all, they just go, you know, I just have a new body now, and you're just going to have to deal with it.
You're just going to roll with it.
And then even in...
Just going to happen.
Even in the war games, they just go, you just can't change what I look like without consulting me. And then they change what he looks like without consulting
they do.
Him. Or do they?
Gallifrey bad.
Dun, dun, dun. Ooh. Fugitive Doctor 6B, all that.
This is the only TV story to give Cybermen characters individual names, Krang, Jarl, etc.
After this, and in other expanded media, not actually in the story.
I saw this, I was like, I don't remember this, but I'm going to include it anyway. Just because. After this, they were only ever named by rank. First Doctor's last words were originally scripted as something similar like, no, I simply will not give in. Time was running short towards the end of production, and Derek Martinus opted not to record the line, wanting to ensure that the regeneration sequence was recorded as well as possible. As a result, the First Doctor's last words were simply, ah, yes, thank you, that's good, keep warm. In Twice Upon a Time, the Doctor's final words are given as, well then, here we go, the long way round. The regeneration scene took a whole day to film.
The Twice Upon a Time thing, and I don't want to relitigate Twice Upon a Time, because I've only seen it once. Ben and Polly just don't seem to get into the TARDIS at the end of Twice Upon a Time. I guess in that continuity, they just froze to death. I don't know. It was just very funny. Also, I know they probably explained it, but I still can't remember how the TARDIS... Like, is it like a time shift thing? Like, does the TARDIS dematerialise while they're there and then come back? I can't remember. It's been a while.
I have not watched it since it aired.
Yeah. Many people haven't, I would say.
I will get... We're going through the rewatch. We're just getting to the end of Donna's run in the new Who rewatch. So.
Well, enjoy series 5. It's my favourite new Who series.
I think it's going to be a series of peaks and troughs. Yes.
Well, you can watch Chibbers' first contribution to new Who.
Yeah.
Our friend Chibbers.
Our buddy.
We have to pretend he's our friend now because he gave us Thasmid.
What else we got here? In the original script, the Cybermen had human faces, albeit rather similar, with a metal plate under their hair. Their hands were also to be human, although their arms would be transparent, made up of rods and lights. A movable arm was also to extend from each Cyberman's chest unit, but such an accessory was considered too costly to implement.
A bit Beeble-Broxian, I suppose.
Would have been cool. Would have been very different.
Imagine if they were like the Ex Machina Alicia Vikander thing, where it's just a face on a robot body.
That would have been really cool. I would have liked that. Michael Kreis, who played Ben, found this work difficult as he'd just undergone surgery to remove a bone chip from his nose, during which he suffered a burst blood vessel which nearly cost him his life, and the Jabba-like snow blown around on the film stage irritated his nose badly. Nonetheless, Kreis was undeterred from asking out production assistant Edwina Werner, whose job it was to throw the Jabba-like into the wind machines, and the two were subsequently married.
That's so cute, what the fuck?
I did spend quite a while trying to think of a meet-cute pun for this, and I got nowhere.
Cute.
Had nothing. Annika Wills recalled that the Cybermen had her in stitches because they looked so cheap, but the actors were all 6-foot hunks. Michael Kreis initially didn't think much of the Cybermen recording, they were all held together by sellotape. So it says a lot about the production to have upped it from that.
Definitely does, yeah. But yeah, thank you. That was also very enlightening behind the scenes stuff. I enjoyed it.
You're very welcome.
I also have in my mum's book about Doctor Who Cybermen, because she let me keep it on an extended loan. How the Cybermen were created, an introduction by Jerry Davis.
Hmm.
Kit Pedler was apparently a medical researcher at the University of London, which is his specific technical focus, which is why all of his nuclear physics makes no sense. Intrigued, I invited Kit around to the Doctor Who office on Shepherd's Bush Green and tried his creative facilities out with a speculative sci-fi theme. An unknown planet emerges to join the solar system and comes into orbit alongside the Earth. It starts to drain the Earth's energy supply. Then astronomers notice that it is a reverse image of the Earth. What happens next? His answer, which we developed in subsequent discussion, eventually became the basis of our first joint Doctor Who Cybermen adventure, The Tenth Planet. Previous scientists I'd interviewed usually closed the door to further speculation. It couldn't happen because... Kit Pedler was different. I gave him another tester. What if some alien intelligence gets inside the top of the post office tower and decided to take over London? What kind of entity would it be? Then you skip a bit and it says, meanwhile, we needed a new monster. I asked Kit what his greatest phobia was as a doctor. This is a good question. Dehumanizing medicine, he answered. You start with artificial arms and legs, very necessary and beneficial, but what if medical science eventually makes it possible to replace all of a human's organs, heart, lungs, stomach, with metal and plastic replacements? At what stage would that person stop feeling human and become robotic? That's it, I said. This is definitely not how the conversation went. Men with everything replaced by cybernetics, lacking the human feelings of love, pity, mercy, fear, compassion, and invulnerable to cold or heat. That explains the hands. What terrible adversaries they would make. Cybernetic men. Cybermen. They would be like computers, motivated by pure logic, said Kit. If it was logical to kill you, they would, if you got in their way. What could motivate those loveless, sexless beings? God. Hmm. We decided on power. History, after all, was full of human monsters who sacrificed love and family for the thrill of power. And survival, added Kit. These men have sacrificed their arms, legs, their entire bodies in order to survive and become immortal. When a part wears out, they replace it. They could survive indefinitely. Perhaps we shall all go that way in the future.
Hmm.
But yeah, apparently they sketched out a rough idea. They had a costume made by the BBC costume department and they had someone try it out in a South London street market.
Oh, wow. That's really intense. Yeah.
That's the alleged conversation that led to the introduction of the Cybermen. I would definitely say alleged at this point. Probably there was more beer involved.
Yep, sensible. Yes, definitely beer, just beer.
Definitely.
We'll all go, except Miss Shaw.
Oh, just a minute, I'm not going to miss all...
No, Miss Shaw.
Have you never heard of female emancipation?
Liz, this time I think he's right.
I see that your first note is Mondasian Cyberman voices.
I just...
In all caps.
Or I think we've already discussed this in various ways. I think it's neat.
It is neat.
I enjoy them. I think it's neat.
Yes, it is good. Time for another rambling conversation about Cybermen and the Uncanny Valley.
That's the entire thing about, especially the Mondesian Cybermen. The uncanniness is off the charts.
Like, the further we get from this episode, the further away we get from the Uncanny Valley for the Cybermen. Like, they're still scary, but they're no longer so clearly human adjacent. We did discuss this earlier in the episode as well. Mm. Like, at this point, with this massive boxy apparatus that is clearly mechanically providing heart, lungs, liver, whatever, like, there's this sort of perception that that could be you in an alternate universe. And also the eyes behind the masks, and it's all just very it's all very
There's enough that, like, the primal fear of not feeling as well that it taps
into. This fear of being, like, not even incapable of empathy, but detached from the concept of empathy. Because even people who find it hard to feel empathy understand, like, what feeling emotions is. Like, they know what emotions are, even if they find it hard to understand other people's emotions. But, like, just completely detached from the concept. Not even knowing...
To be withdrawn from your own feeling.
Placing no importance on emotion as a sort of motivator or as a factor in decision-making.
Mm.
All pure logic, which is definitely never emotionally driven.
The production design is really good.
It is really, really good. The sets, the visual design, the graphic design on the screen.
It feels like a big episode.
It does.
It feels like...
The set is very convincing as like a subterranean base.
Mm.
There's no windows. It's very cramped. I do think the projector room as a concept is a bit weird. Is it just like their rec room that has a projector in it? There should be more sofas in it. There should be a pool table.
Maybe it's where they project data when they need to see it bigger.
Maybe. Such as...
But then they do have films.
Such as when they have to watch Wagon Wheel for very serious scientific reasons.
We've all been there.
I'm sure. I also wanted to say, I watched a friend of the show, Will's, Cybersember episode about the 10th Planet, and he noted that it has kind of a Thunderbirds vibe.
It really does. The underground base and the...
Which I really enjoy.
Across all of the communication to other parts of the world.
It's wonderful.
Mm.
Sorry, there's a bit about the international element of the space station, which I guess we can move on to, theoretically.
Mm-hmm.
Just listen to all that variety of accents and nationalities, and even, my God, different skin colours. It doesn't matter particularly that the cast is stereotyping the types of foreigners that they're depicting. Then we get a horny Italian who sings Verdi, or an American who shouts a lot and calls the Doctor Pop, because it's a forgivable shorthand to demonstrate that this story has truly international consequences. It's helped by all the maps in Vigna's office, let alone that there's someone in African dress. It all contributes to an atmosphere of world concern never yet felt in Doctor Who before. And this is compounded on by the scenes on Zeus 4, in which the extremely realistic acting from Earl Cameron and Alan White, as the space pilots who begin to panic as they lose control of their spaceship, make for some of the tensest scenes seen in the Hartnell era. And all this achieved by two actors always static, sitting in a couple of armchairs side by side. It's pretty good. I like the International Space Command. We talked about this in Tomb of the Cybermen and in the Moon Base, but sort of the international, like, fight back against adversity, like the diverse group trying to destroy the homogenizing, assimilating force. It's good. I think we should have one that's just like a metaphor for LGBT being anti-assimilation politics, all that kind of thing. Having a family is not assimilation. There are other things that are assimilation, but having a family is not one of them. As a point for listeners who may think that I have some iffy queer politics. Apparently the actor playing Cutler is Canadian, not American, but he does well with it anyway. But yeah, good shit. Obviously Earl Cameron is fucking cool. He lived to the age of 102, as you have noted.
Really cool. Reportedly the first black actor to play an astronaut on TV. Very cool. And became the third actor who's ever been in Doctor Who to reach 100 years of age. Don't know who the other two are.
I'm wondering if this is, like, this appearance of a black spaceman, whether people sort of link it with... There was that one particular comic in a pulp magazine in, like, the 50s, in which an astronaut was revealed to be a black man on the last page, but I cannot remember the name of the comic.
I have not heard of this.
Judgment Day, I think.
Cool.
In the 1950s, the portrayal of a black man in a position of authority and a discussion of racism in a comic was at the centre of a battle between entertaining comics editor William Gaines and the Comics Code Authority, which had been set up in 1954 to self-regulate the content of US comics amid fears that they were a corrupting influence on youth. Gaines frequently fought with the CCA in an attempt to keep his magazines free from censorship. The particular example noted by comics historian D.B. Deal Gaines threatened Judge Charles Murphy, the comics code administrator, with a lawsuit when Murphy ordered EC to alter the science fiction story Judgment Day in Incredible Science Fiction number 33. The story, by writer Alpha Feldstein and artist Joe Orlando, was a reprint from the pre-code Weird Fantasy number 18, April 1953, inserted when the code authority had rejected an initial original story in An Eye for an Eye, but was itself also objected to because of the central character being black. Thank you, comics code authority. I knew you were racist, but I just needed some proof. Interesting. The story depicted a human astronaut, a representative of the Galactic Republic, visiting the planet Sabrina, inhabited by robots. He finds the robots divided into functionally identical orange and blue races. This is a classic sci-fi setup. One of which has fewer rights and privileges than the other. The astronaut decides that due to the robot's bigotry, the Galactic Republic should not admit the planet. In the final panel, he removes his helmet, revealing himself to be a black man. Murphy demanded, without any authority in the code, that the black astronaut had to be removed. So that's the story I was thinking of. Oh yeah, I was thinking about what type of energy Mondas is absorbing, and then it hit me. Mondas is a resurrection beast, and Thanagy explains it. That, dear listeners, is a reference to The Locked Tomb, which you should read. And by the time this episode comes out, it will definitely be pre-order season for Nona the Ninth. So,
and I will have finished Harrow.
Yes, because otherwise I'm going to spoil Nona the Ninth for AIM.
We don't know how you could do that.
No, there's no reason. Mystery. I just have mind powers.
Let me get this straight. A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard, it can move anywhere in time and space?
Yes.
Quite so.
But that's ridiculous.
I did read a tiny amount of the novelization, and then I lost interest, because novelizations are boring a lot of the time. Sorry, Jerry Davis. Also, Tomb of the Cybermen novelization sucked, so I don't have high hopes. But yeah, there's a bit at the beginning where they're describing the dynamics in the thing, and it says that Cutler easily dominated the other two men, and I was like, oh, did he? Did he easily dominate the other two men? also, the introduction completely fucks up the cyber timeline by claiming that the Mondasian Cybermen came from Telos and had already been Cybermen. It's like, no, that's literally not what it says in the fucking story, Jerry Davis. Literally, the words that you wrote were different than that. It's fine. But yeah, so speaking of Mondasian Cybermen, there were a couple of different like things with the novelization, not like a huge amount. Cutler tries to shoot Ben, but gets stopped by Barclay. There's a new guy called Rogers. They give Barclay a first name, like all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Also, they give all the Cybermen names, so they're called Crail, Krang, Jarl, and Gurn, which are not really names. They're just sort of consonant clusters with a vowel in the middle. Crail is the main one. Apparently they were called cyber leaders, and Krang is described as having a black helmet and the cybership being missile shaped, as it would be in Revenge of the Cybermen, the Fourth Doctor story, because they were trying to tie it in with the current continuity. And also, no one had watched The Tenth Planet since it came out, because that's how television worked. Another soldier is present with the sergeant at the TARDIS when he is attacked by the Cybermen. The sergeant's neck is described rather vividly as being completely shattered by his opponent, now lolling at a grotesque angle. The unnamed offsider is killed with his own crowbar, the assaulting Cyberman smashing his helmet and skull like an eggshell. Jesus Christ. The language in general was stronger than permitted in the televised version, so presumably people say hell and damn and stuff. No bastards or fucks yet.
I'm raising my eyebrows again.
The events of the televised version were set in 1986, but in the novelization the year is given as 2000, and as mentioned, there's more signs of the Doctor being ill, and he mistakes Ben for Ian and Polly for Barbara. And Ben and Polly are implied to come from the 70s rather than the 60s, which is just incorrect because we know that the war machines happened in 1965. That's just canon. And it also means that Barbara and Ian could be hanging around. Who knows? But yeah, so that's a couple of the changes. There is more stuff, but it's not super important. let's talk about Mondasian Cybermen. So obviously the Mondasian Cybermen are Cybermen that come from Mondas, Kelsapris. They have a different evolutionary cycle and also various offshoots. But just based on the ones that have cloth for faces, we're going to have a talk. So Crail, the main cyber baddie, is Eric from Spare Parts, which as soon as you listen to Spare Parts, AIM, you're going to be fucking devastated. Yes. It's so sad. God,
okay.
Spare Parts.
Cool. Can't wait for my heart to be broken.
Yes, Cybermondan was the term used by the Cybermen to refer to the Mondasians who did not fully embrace cyberconversion like the faction did. As such, they were the earliest form of Cybermen. That's from a book called Iceberg, which I think is a Seventh Doctor adventure. It sounds interesting. I've never managed to finish a new series adventure novel. I started reading Human Nature, and I liked it, and I liked Benny, and then I just never finished it. So, gotta get back to that at some point. Somewhat contradicting the above accounts, this is a common phrase on Cyberman Wikipedia pages.
Existence.
While the faction left Mondas for Planet 14, which is another place that Cybermen come from, the Cybermondans remained on their homeworld until they returned to Earth. After a failed invasion in 1954, which is from one of the comics, they returned in 1986 to steal Earth's energy before being defeated by the First Doctor because of their susceptibility to radiation. So the Cybermen in this are actually Cybermondans because they're not completely converted. Like, they still have eyes and stuff. This would later be recorded in the Cyber Race's history computer as their second invasion attempt of Earth, and that's prose from Iceberg. Obviously, it becomes tricky because the invasion is a like a Talosian Cyberman thing, so it's kind of like a different strokes of different folks. Iceberg sounds fucking wild, for the record. In 2006, the world is about to be overwhelmed by a disaster that might destroy human civilization, the inversion of the Earth's magnetic field. I feel like this is quite a common problem in Doctor Who novels.
Yeah.
It just happens every other Friday.
I think we've been there before.
Like, oh, it's Tuesday? Yeah, the magnetic field's about to invert itself. Deep in an Antarctic base, the Flitback team is frantically devising a system to reverse the change in polarity.
Hey, that's us!
Above them, the SS Elysium carries its jet-set passengers on the ultimate cruise. On board is Ruby Duval, a journalist sent to record the Flitback moment. Instead, she finds a man called the Doctor, who is locked out of the strange green box he said is merely as part of his time machine. I don't know why it's green, this is probably another thing from the novels. And she finds old enemies of the Doctor, silver giants at work beneath the ice. Very mysterious. And the Doctor... says that Cybermen are only alien if you debate the term alien, because they were human once on Mondas, because they were, I guess the implication is that they had parallel evolution or something, because there's no way that they like traveled between the planets.
No, parallel evolution makes the most sense.
Maybe they were conjoined planets and then they slowly split over the course of a long time. I don't fucking know. Anyway, the Cybermondans' eyes were ruby crystals. And they were capable of hypnotism, because they're in the Silver Turk, which I do own and have listened to, but not for a really long time. The Silver Turk is a Eighth Doctor audio with Mary Shelley as his companion. So
I've heard of this one. It sounds wild.
It's exciting. Obviously, we're talking about Spare Parts. Just to be like, listen to fucking Spare Parts, Aim. I'm begging you. I'm not describing the plot until you fucking listen to Spare Parts.
I will
this
do
is
that
even
to
more urgent than fine. Reading the end of Harry the Ninth. Like, I won't spoil the end of the Ninth for you until you've fucking listened to fucking... Oh my god, Spare Parts is so good. And it's got Nyssa in it, so like, there's no excuse for you not to listen to it.
I know, there's no reason why I shouldn't. It sounds everything I like and think.
Yeah, Spare Parts, listeners, is like the fucking... It's definitely top five Big Finish audio of all time. It's so good. Like, thank you, Mark Platt, for my life. Thank you for the Battlefield novelization. Thank you for Spare Parts. Thank you for other stuff as well, but those are the main ones. There's also...
I know, I will listen to it. I'm so sorry.
There's also something called... Don't apologise, I'm just being hyperbolically mean. I don't mind that you haven't listened to it. You have a life.
Thing is, I mind.
Yeah, there's also something called The Reaping, which just has a couple... Which just sounds cool as a name. At an indeterminate point in the far future, though not before the 52nd century, the British monarchy was abolished and the last monarch was executed. Footage of that event could be viewed via the Gogglebox.
Ooh.
I'm bopping my head. I'm like, yeah. Abolish the monarchy. Abolish the monarchy.
That sounds like a fun
maybe
thing
by the time
do,
this episode comes out, the Queen will probably be dead. Like, be properly dead. Not just privately dead.
I mean, publicly dead.
Publicly dead. They'll have announced her public
comes
death.
Comes out as
so
dead.
She won't have 69 years of her reign or whatever.
Sad.
But yeah.
I was telling one of my colleagues about that the other day, and he was like, that sounds fake. She's been seen. And I'm like, has she
been seen?
Are you sure?
They could be releasing old photos. I don't fucking know. And then finally, the second Doctor Who adventure game from the 2011, which I desperately want to play and could not find a torrent for anywhere, it's called Blood of the Cybermen. This one is, like, debatably Mondasian Cyberman, but from a continuity standpoint, like, because of the where it's set in the timeline, but because they only had the models for Cybers Industry Cybermen, they're just Cybers Industry Cybermen with no, like, signal on their chest. But cool. I thought it was really important that I brought it up, because number one, it's set on the 4th of May, which is my birthday, and number two, Amy asks the Doctor if he's seen the thing, and he asks which version, specifically. He says, like, do you mean the one with Kurt Russell, or the Howard Hawks one from the 50s? My kind
that
of
that sounds
Lord.
Like it was written precisely for you.
I know, like, Will did a video about it. I really want to play it, because it sounds like, the adventure games is from, like, the various reviews that I've seen were, like, fine. And I remember watching a video of, like, Rory going around and knocking out a bunch of Sontarans from one that was set in the fucking gunpowder plot. Like, they sound great. There was one about...
That sounds really
fun.
There
was one with the Cybermen, one with the Daleks, one with the Sontarans. And I think there was a fourth one, or possibly a fourth one was planned and then not released. And then they took them down off the fucking website, so you can't even download them anymore. And it's like, where am I supposed to get this? I'm not paying for an illegal download.
Internet Archive?
I mean, I've looked. But I'll keep looking and I'll put a link in the show notes if one pops up. And then I just want to briefly mention The Short Trip. This one I have read, but not recently. This is Mondas Passing, which is a story about Ben and Polly meeting back up in 1986. Because, foolishly, this author seems to think that Ben and Polly would not have stayed together forever.
Wrong.
Now, this is not...
categorically incorrect.
This isn't just me being like, you know, I think heterosexual marriage is the only solution for a romantic relationship. I just think that having them break up arbitrarily is kind of a dark and gritty Doctor Who symptom, where they're like, well, Ian and Barbara are happy, so Ben and Polly can't be happy too. Like, they seem to think that the class difference is completely incompatible. And it's like, no, they've travelled together for like 2 years. They know each other very well. I can see them having arguments. I can't see them like actively going, I'm never seeing you again, and then only meeting up in 1986. Anyway, it was written by Paul Bryce, who wrote, it was a pseudonym by Stephen Cole because he couldn't say that he wrote like half the stories in Short Trips. Basically, it's December 31st, 1986, which is obviously the date in the story. Ben and Polly meet up in a hotel room and they're reminiscing about their experience at the snow-capped space tracking station in Antarctica. While Ben waits for Polly to arrive, he watches the news for any mention of Mondas's approach. Polly arrives, and while there is an awkward moment, they soon begin recalling their adventures and their friends, the Doctor and Jamie. This is sweet because they're like, yeah, Jamie, who was like so surprised to be on the moon. It's very cute. Ben speculates that various organisations may have hushed up the events of Snowcap, and they part ways ready to face the new year. It's mentioned that they're both married to other people, and it's like, is this when Polly is married to her gay husband? I can't remember. But yeah, it's like it's a good story, but it just doesn't fill my heart with joy, you know?
Yeah, it sounds kind of unnecessarily gritty for the sake of grittiness's sake.
Yeah, like Ben laments that he might never see Polly again. And then it's like, according to canon, as in the real canon, the Five Companions audio and the Sarah Jane Adventures, they get married and then start an orphanage in India.
That's cute. Yeah. That's what they would have wanted
as
well.
They are lovely and I love them. Man, I have some thoughts and passions about this Stephen Cole. It is good. I also wanted to quickly shout out Baby Bell on AO3, who wrote Butch Lesbian Ben / Femme Lesbian Polly fanfiction.
Beautiful.
Powerful. Have to
That's actually the energy we need for this.
Thank you, Bell, who is on the Doctor Who Discord that I'm in. I love you. But yeah, so that's the Expanded Universe segment, I guess. I sort of sped run it so that you could go to sleep.
Anyway, rankings. Yes. My X of the week is gonna be sound pleasing to my ears, and it's the Mondasian Cybermen voices. I just think it's neat.
Yeah, it's good. Sorry, I'm just quickly putting Talons of Wang Chiang at number 40 on our ranking list. We can always move it when we record it. I don't think we
can
will.
Move it next week.
My X of the week is certified look of the week, which is the Cybermen wearing the capes over their big heads.
That's absolutely iconic. Very fitting. Nice little, yeah. I like it.
It's wonderful. So we have 1 degree of Blake 7 today because Robert Beatty, who played Cutler, was in the Blake 7 episode The Way Back as Baron Foster, which once again is the pilot episode of Blake 7 in which Blake gets accused of child molestation. In those words. Not sure I can say thanks, Terry, on that one, I'll be honest. So while Avon doesn't appear in this episode, he was in Terry Nation's first draft as the convict who says to Blake, take a long look, that's the last you'll ever see of Earth. That's my
Claire
Avon impression. A number of props and sets used on this show also appear on Doctor Who. An easily spotted one in this episode is the sofas that look rather like layers of PVC sandbags with a huge screen behind them in the Justice Department, which appear most prominently in Androids of Death. So I'm going to make a note on that for my future installations of these segments.
Nice.
And then for a prop effect, during the entry scene to the records room, the computer operator is seen wearing a box device connected to earphones and some form of eyewear. Production being in the latter half of 1977, it makes the device a foreshadowing of the impending first generation of the hugely popular Sony Walkman that was likely already being put through prototype tests.
Nice.
Fantastic addition there from the IMDb trivia page. I feel like we come across the Way Back a lot on this connections bit, and I'm not sure why. It's not like there's significantly more actors in that episode.
It just happens to have a lot of synergy.
Yeah, I guess because the main cast is only Blake of the main cast is in the first episode, except is Vila in the first episode? Not sure. But he's like the main guy, and then everyone else either dies or is part of the Justice Department. So there's a lot of people who aren't in other episodes. But yeah. Out of 5, I guess.
Out of five, I'm gonna give it 4 pin-up pictures of women out of five.
Fucking took mine. I'm gonna give it 4 radiation ponchos out of 5. I love this story.
Nice,
like,
stylish.
Probably objectively speaking, as a Base Under Siege, it's not like a better Base Under Siege than many others, but the presence of the Cyberman elevates this story so much.
I think there's enough important beats.
Yeah,
that
the presence
well.
And the design and the general, like, the acting's really good, and there's the regeneration, and it's just fucking incredible.
Where are we putting it in our overall
Ooh,
rankings?
I would say pretty high. As you know, at number 1, we have Lawrence of the Daleks, and at number 40, we have The Talons of Wang Chiang, which we've definitely already watched.
TBC last week.
We've definitely already watched. to be confirmed in the past, because we're time travellers. oh my god, there's so many good ones near the top
it's
now.
It's hard,
Fuck.
Isn't it? I think I am happy to be pushing this. I put it between Fury from the Deep and
I was
Earthshock.
Literally thinking that.
Perfect.
I was like, great. Do I like it more than Earthshock? And I'm like, yeah, I think it is better than Earthshock. Like, I love Earthshock. I think it's great. But also the Cybermen in that one are not as perfectly Cybermen as the Cybermen here. So, and I have feelings about the Cybermen, as you know, which is ironic.
I am aware.
Novelization, I haven't finished reading it. So I would still say this is an NA. But I tried, you know, I really tried. And now let's look up the ranking on the Gallifrey Matrix thing. So what are we thinking for the 10th
I think
month?
This is going to be like around 19.
I'm going to say this is at 60. Let's find out. Just because it's never as high as we want it to be. 55!
Okay,
it
that's
is below
bollocks.
The Unquiet Dead and above the Fires of Pompeii. It's also above the Three Doctors, which is very debatable because the Three Doctors is perfect.
Every single multi-doctor story
yeah,
is
I feel
perfect.
Like they have done one of these more recently, but it's not available on a Wikipedia page, so we can't rank it more easily. Definitely these days, I think the First Doctor would be more appreciated. There's a very, very heavy recency bias.
So.
And also a people who subscribe to Doctor Who magazine bias until I subscribed and became...
I also don't think they'd reanimated episode 4 by the time this survey was done.
Yeah, thank you very much everyone for listening to Reversing Polarity, a Doctor Who fancast, and our thanks for listening to my mouse noises as I ate a Subway cookie at the beginning of this episode. if you would like to, you can rate and review us on iTunes or Spotify. If you just listen to us on Google Podcasts, absolutely no shade. It's good. It's what I use. Please find and follow us on Twitter at PolarityPod or on Tumblr at polaritypod.tumblr.com. We have been getting more anons recently and we love it. Thank you very much.
Oh,
it's so lovely.
Good.
Shout out to Jamie.
Heart. Thank
we love
you.
You.
Yes.
There's also mine and Aim's individual Twitters. Mine is at .sayers, which is also now my AO3 username because I changed it. Represent 2022. The year of changing things. and Aim's is at Aim Tells Stories. I'm not going to spell Aim this time
you can
because
find
you
me.
Listened to this podcast for 41 episodes.
And I'm at Aim Tells Stories on pretty much everything
yes,
at
absolutely.
This stage.
Once again, thank you very much for listening. And please do join us next episode for The Genesis of the Daleks. Fuck! We're doing Genesis of the Daleks next?